are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, May 10th, 2015. My name is Michael Brooks, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Maria Hanoun and Sophie Spahn on their article in Foreign Policy, When Europe Loved Islam. Historically informed regressivism on today's Majority Report. There was a time in Berlin and London when Islam was like Buddhism was in the 1970s in Cali. We're going to talk about it on today's show and how religion morphs and moves and changes depending on its historical situation and this untold history of when in 1920s Berlin it was trendy and avant-garde to be a Muslim. Also, Donald Trump's national finance chairman is a Wall Street elite who profited off of the housing crisis. Shocking. I thought he was in it to disrupt the system. I mean, it's true. Sadiq Khan, London's new mayor, in his first act as mayor, went to a Holocaust memorial. And Donald Trump says he might do a very, very good job. And if he does, he'll be an exception to the Muslim ban. I mean, it's true. It's absolutely true. Did the Obama administration deceive all of the world's most prominent arms control experts in the United States and Israel in order to sell their deal with Iran? Well, that's according to a funny new profile of Ben Rhodes, Obama's national security advisor in the New York Times. That's been getting some debunk. Talk about that. And is China going to clean up in Iran business after the deal with Iran, in spite of the European Union's intention to get in on that? Bernie Sanders calls out MSNBC, noting their corporate ownership, and says that there needs to be a Democratic Fox News available. A Hillary Clinton strategist demonstrates exactly how not to appeal to a Bernie or Buster and demonstrates some of the enduring problems in that campaign as we head into the general election and the poll numbers get tight. Could Sam and I have been wrong about how easy this is going to be? I guess Hillary Clinton would be the one Democrat who could snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. And Loretta Lynch, in a strong statement, promises that the Obama administration is going to battle against discrimination in North Carolina. All that and a whole lot more on today's program. Everybody, a new Two Dope Boys dropped today. We had Young Kim on, who's a former writer for Vibe and now runs a group called the Madbury Club. We talked about misogyny and lemonade. We remembered Prince and fawned over him. And we talked about a Geico skywriting ad that denied the Armenian genocide. It's pretty interesting. Go to twodopeboyspod.com. Go to the subscribe page and join us there. People are giving it great feedback. I mean, look, it's true. It's really true. That happened today. My allergies are active today. I'm exhausted. And because I know my mother might actually watch this. She never watches or listens when Sam hosts, but sometimes she deigns to listen or watch when I host. I shaved because she doesn't like all that beard nonsense. And I shaved, of course, with my amazing Harry's razor. Stop compromising on your shave and get started with Harry's. For far too long, and I speak from personal experience, you've either paid too much for a comfortable shave or you've settled for a low-priced but low-quality razor that cuts your face up, that just makes you look like you're an extra in Fight Club, but you didn't really even get properly punched. Harry's offers something you've never had before, a great shave at a fair price. Harry's makes its own high-quality razor, cuts out the middleman, and ships them directly to you for half the price of the leading brands. A good shave, a good price. It's simple. Get the best of both with Harry's. As I say, as soon as I went to Harry's, I've not turned back. There's no part of it that I want to go back to. I don't want to go back to the ridiculous, like, double-locked, like, Mission Impossible style systems at the drugstore to buy my overpriced razors. I certainly can't do, I mean, I have sensitive skin and it just, I mean, I just get torn up if I use any kind of low quality razors. I can't get away with it. And every day with Harry's and the Harry's cream, it's just consistently, it's a pleasurable experience to shave. All of a sudden, you want to lock yourself in the bathroom, turn off your phone, and just shave for as long as possible. It's kind of weird, but it feels great. Harry's makes just one razor with all you need for a close, comfortable shave. 5 German-crafted blades, flex hinge, and lubricating strip. Quality guaranteed. Full refund if you're not happy. And a good price. Factory direct prices. Cut out the middleman. No upcharges. Half the price of the leading brand. Harry's starter set is just $15. That includes a razor, 3 blades, and your choice of Harry's shave cream or foaming gel. I prefer the gel. Always did cream before, but I actually love the Harry's gel. As an additional bonus, you can get $5 off of your first purchase with my code MAJORITYREPORT. That's my code, Majority Report. After using the Majority Report code, you can get an entire month's worth of shaving for just $10. Harry's.com was created by 2 guys passionate about creating a better shaving experience for everybody. It delivers superior shave for an incredible price and is brought to you straight from the German factory with the highest quality blades for almost a century. By cutting out the middleman, Harry's offers an amazing shave at a fraction of the price of the drugstore brands. Shipping is always free and simple and direct. There's no long, convoluted sign-up process or anything like that. The Harry starter set called the Truman is a great option for new customers and is an amazing deal. For just $15, you get a razor handle, moisturizing shave cream, and 3 of Harry's 5-blade German engineered razors. Plus, there's a special offer for fans of the show. As I've said, Harry's will give you 5 off of your first purchase with promo code MAJORITYREPORT. So go to harrys.com right now, enter promo code MAJORITYREPORT at checkout, get $5 off, and help the show today. There's a link to it on our website. Stop compromising and give Harry's a try right now. We will be right back to talk about when Europe loved Islam.
Yeah. Clear enough for you. All right. Yeah. Yeah. Look, man, right. Y'all supposed to be happy and free. Y'all can see why y'all wanted me to stay in jail. Oh, busters. Picture me rolling in my 500 Benz. I got no love for these tens. There's no need to be friends. They got me under surveillance. I swear somebody can tell it. No, there's no being sold. But I ain't the one telling. Don't want to be another number. I got a gang of weed to keep you going under. The federalists want to see me dead. Chicken the prices on my head. Now I got 2 rock bottles by my bed. I feed them lead. Now I'm released. How will I live? Will God forgive me for all the dirt and thick and dead? We kids. One life to live. It's so hard to be positive. Ain't no shooting at your crib. Mama, I'm still thugging. The world is a war zone. My homies is inmates, and most of them dead grown. Full grown, finally a man. Still scheming on ways to put some greatest on the palms of my empty hands. Just picture me rolling, flossing the beans on rims that isn't stolen. My dreams are sensing, my hopes are born. I'm like a fiend and finally seeing all that dope is gone. My nerves are wet, heart beating, and my head's swollen. Thinking of the G's I'll be holding. Picture me rolling. Easy now.
side a little bit so you can get a clear picture. Can you see it? Picture me wrong. Yeah. Guess who's back?
I got keys coming from overseas. Calling in the 200 G's. I'm a street commando, Nino, for example. This lavish lifestyle is hard to handle. So I got the flaws because I'm more like a boss player. Thug ready to be a woman.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I am Michael Brooks, and joining us now is, Maria Hanoun. She is a PhD student at Georgetown University. And Sophie Spahn, she is a PhD candidate at Utrecht University in the Netherlands. They are both studying Islamic and Arabic studies at their respective institutions, and they are the co-authors of a recent piece in Foreign Policy magazine, When Europe Loved Islam. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us on the show.
Yeah, exactly.
Sophie, I want to start with you, but I'm going to go to both of you on this before we get to your article. There is a very powerful public discourse now on Islam, and it comes through a number of filters. Often on this show, we talk about Islam and Middle East issues, I would say, through primarily a policy lens that is informed by history, culture, geography, anthropology, and economics. There's also a predominant discourse, which is very trendy right now and very popular in sort of the world of Reddit and online, that kind of reduces Islam and religion generally to some sort of like scientific proposition that is correct or not. And of course, you know, scientifically it's not correct. So therefore, you know, Islam or Christianity or whatever is quote unquote wrong. I want to know from the perspective of somebody who actually studies this academically and historically, what is the mechanism through which you study Islam as an academic and an actual expert in the field? Sophie, I'm starting with you, but Maria, I want you to jump in right after.
Well, I think that if you study any sort of topic academically or more in depth, you'll find that everything is more complicated than it seems, and that there are different facets to a story, and that you can also not, you know, there are many different types of Islam, there are many different types of religion. It's really hard to generalize too much. Besides that, I mean, I was trained originally as a historian, and I'm researching a very sort of a very historical project, so I'm approaching it in that way as well. So in a specific context, specific time, specific actors, mm-hmm. that would be, I think, my perspective on that.
Yeah, and just to echo what Sophie's saying, I mean, I think that the study of Islam, Islamic studies could mean so many things. So for some people, for some of my colleagues, that means studying Islamic law and the centuries of legal tradition that have developed around Islam. For some people, it's looking at practice, how those laws have been applied in practice. For some people, it is looking at the Quran and how the Quran is constructed and trying to understand the language. And for us, you know, we're both more historians. We study intellectual history. And so we look at people who think about how Islam, you know, is enacted in society through different kinds of political movements, through writing, through literature, and in society with the construction of Islamic institutions. And so to deny that Islam should be kind of engaged with is to deny, you know, centuries of history and a whole, you know, many facets of society.
So you're saying that to complete any, not just a PhD, but any type of academic course of study in these subject matters, you couldn't say, as an example, my thesis is Islam is bad ideas, supporting evidence, Richard Dawkins tweet, and other guy who doesn't have training in Islam with some selected quotes. That right. wouldn't work?
I probably wouldn't pass my dissertation.
Mm.
Yeah, you would make it to the doctorate that way.
Whoa. All right. Well, I guess we're all just regressive apologists, but I just wanted to kind of get that out of the way before we jump into this. So this is fascinating, and Maria, I'll start with you this time. Okay. This piece is When Europe Loved Islam, and there's two different tracks to this conversation. There's a political track and a cultural track. We're going to start culturally.
Great.
In the 1920s, you paint a picture of in Berlin and other important intellectually rigorous and open European capitals and major cities of interest in Islam as something that is totally outside of discourse today, something more analogous to like the way some people might look at Buddhism, actually, as a religion that is more compatible with the modern world, that is more adaptive and responsive to present and modern conditions, and in reaction to a sort of exhaustion with Christianity and modernist projects at Europe at the time. How did Islam start to play that role in Europe in the 1920s? And then specifically, just start with that, and then I'll go to Sophie. Go ahead.
One of the major trends we look at are the kind of movement of people and ideas through empire. And so in this period after World War I, there was a large influx of Muslims into some of these European capitals. There were many scholars, Muslim scholars, immigrants, travelers. And among these were the Ahmadiyya missionaries. So these were missionaries from the Punjab region of British India. And they constructed mosques, and they were very effective missionaries. And so one of the places we look at and is sort of central to our article is the Wilmersdorf Mosque in Berlin. And you see it happening there, where there's this frustration with European sort of Christian society in the wake of World War I. There's a lot of confusion, a lot of disillusionment with modernity and with the past. And so through the Ahmadiyya missions, kind of you can see them tapping into this with their lectures on Islam and modernism and the future and the future of humanity. And so I think that it was just a kind of active and very interesting intellectual climate at this time.
So Sophie, to be clear though, that this mission, and I want you to get more into the specifics of it, and also this idea that was popular at the time across the spectrum of political thought in Europe, of this notion of the new man. Fascists talked about it, socialists talked about it. But that this group from the Punjab was not saying, they weren't coming to Germany and saying the modern world is fallen and corrupted and we need to recreate some fantasized version of the 7th century. They were saying that Islam has a particular insight on how to modernize, which actually in some ways in that context was more egalitarian. There was a strong anti-racist bent. We won't get into this, but also this mission also was in the United States at this time and gained popularity with African Americans because of an anti-racist message. Get into the specifics of what they were saying and how it fit into a specific response to modernity.
Well, first of all, it was a context where in Berlin at that time, there was a space for a lot of sort of people who, activists, students who wanted to act against, Muslim students, activists, wanted to act against British and French imperialism. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, there was a bohemian site for them to come together. And the Ahmadiyya were not the only Muslim actors in Berlin at this time. There were different groups, but they were a very important one, and they were a group with a mosque. Mm-hmm. And their sort of vision of modernity was also linked to the First World War and the devastating effect that had had on Europe and specifically on Germany. So there were many people who felt disillusioned, who felt just disappointed and almost as if Christianity had failed and the war had been a result. So there was a space for these kind of new ideas, and there was a lot of interest in different types of spiritualism, not just Islam, but many, different outlets for these sort of feelings. And the Ahmadiyya were very much trying to promote a very rational, modern, progressive Islam. And that's what they wrote about. And they did this, of course, also to gain converts. But, they felt that this was something that would resonate with all these European intellectuals, which it did. But they had a sort of an intellectual conversation there in the Wilmersdorf Mosque with people from all different backgrounds. So that's what they tapped into. And their magazines, in the one in Berlin and also in Woking, and they published also from British India, they had a very wide reach, and these magazines were read in many different places all over Europe and also in the Muslim world. They were also kind of a controversial movement in a way. But at this time, these sort of identities were quite fluid, and they did have a conversation in the 20s with a lot of different people.
What is, Maria, I want you to talk specifically to this concept of the new man and how these Islamic movements responded to it and put their own specific spin on it.
Yeah, so one thing we talk about in our piece is just how the new man was this sort of philosophical concept that was quite trendy at this time. And it really focused on the individual. And we see it in even Nietzsche's Ubermann as this mm-hmm. person who would be kind of excel in society or a leader. And then in the case of Hugo Marcus, who was one of the important converts in Berlin at this time, and he was actually a gay Jewish philosopher, and he was engaging with all of these people, Spinoza and Kant and Nietzsche and Goethe. And for him, the new man, this sort of utopian ideal of the human being, what was found in Islam. And so he kind of looked at the trajectory of monotheism through Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and saw in Islam the sort of logical conclusion or progression of these monotheisms. And therefore, Islam became the kind of spiritual foundation for the society in which this new man would be, or this sort of ideal man of the future would be constructed. And in his other writings, he really focuses on the kind of progressive and intellectual message of Islam. So another piece that I read by him, he talks about the hadith or sayings of the prophet. And he uses the fact that these sayings were recorded and passed down through generations to show that in the East, sort of interiority and the individual were so important for such a long time. And this is a relatively new concept in Europe. So he kind of is really focusing on the philosophical individualist and very sort of modern message of Islam.
So Sophie, I can already hear the kind of heads exploding over that sort of comment that there was this sense of interiority in Islam and in the East. Now, I think obviously there are distinctions and we have to sort of draw differentiations, and there are different models of government and different ways, you know, people were individuated in politics and religion for that matter. But we have no discourse and understanding of that for most people. When you hear the idea that there was individuality in Islam, people would either have no reference point for it, or they would say that you're making some type of, you know, kind of like postmodern working backwards apology and making up something, projecting backwards into something that wasn't there to begin with. So can you give us more specifics in terms of what that individuality looked like and how it was retrieved and used in these conversations in the 20s in Europe?
Well, see, in this specific context, there were, you know, they were very much trying to be part of Europe. Mm-hmm. And they were trying to approach Europe in a way. Look, they're also part, there were many different sort of Islam reformist movements.
Absolutely.
At this time, also mm-hmm. in the 19th century. So this was not like a completely new idea, but people were conceptualizing new ideas and looking in the Quran and looking in different places to find like ideas of how Islam would be completely aligned with new technologies and all these kind of things. That was already before. And the Ahmadiyya really were trying to show people in Europe, like, you know, you can be European and you can be Muslim. And there's no, the one doesn't exclude the other. So, and someone like Hugo Marcus is also interesting because he looks at Islam not necessarily through a genealogy of Islamic philosophers, but and Islamic scholars, but he looks very much at Islam through this idea of all these European philosophers, mm-hmm. which is, you know, kind of turning that whole idea around as well and going further into, you know, showing that European side in a way rather than only looking towards the East. But then other people did other things. So there's a huge variation as well in the way that people were approaching these intellectual conversations. But they always say, yeah, there was this really this idea that we're looking towards the future and we're taking some texts and we're taking ideas and we're trying to create the best future in Europe. And that would have included Islam in that way.
Yeah, and I do think that, you know, the individual and the individual's relationship with society was such an important question in the post-war, World War One and sort of interwar period. And so, and I mean, we even see it earlier in the history of kind of European philosophy. And so tapping into that, I think the Ahmadiyya mission really was tapping into those questions as well and kind of looking at how Islam could help facilitate or explain how the individual functions in society and as part of this modern society.
Okay, so let's move to the political track. You make another sort of interesting historical point here, and there's two sides of it, both of which we'll get to. That first of all, at this time in history, the European governments were pretty partial towards Muslims in some respects, and partial towards them as kind of like people that they wanted to be local partners in colonial enterprises. As an example, there was seemed to be certainly preferential treatment for Muslims versus Jews, as an example, in certain fighting regiments for European colonial powers. And then the other aspect was that the European powers were sort of anticipating and seeing that Islam was going to be utilized in anti-colonial struggles. So there's kind of a dual track that are connected here. But Maria, start by explaining how European governments, very specifically in this period of time, empowered Islam, built mosques. I mean, now there's a debate on banning minarets and, you know, banning Islamic symbols in many European countries. This was a time when the public coffers were used to build and subsidize Islam.
Yeah, so this is definitely, Sophie can speak more to this, but in the wake of World War One, there was such a, during World War One, we see the colonial powers, France and Britain, using their Muslim soldiers and trying to court the favor of Muslim citizens in the colonies. I mean, a large percentage of their colonial subjects were Muslim. And so trying to kind of gain favor with these populations in the sort of global power struggle at the time, but then also having Muslims serve in the army in World War One was a big part of these two great powers' agenda. And so we do see some preferential treatment towards Muslims that we talk about in our piece, which is quite interesting. So these regiments would have imams within them, embedded within the regiments. And instead of pork and wine, they were given couscous and coffee and mint tea. So they were being sort of favored in this way, in a way that Jewish troops, for example, were not. In terms of the mosque, we talk about the Paris Mosque, which was built in the 1920s in the wake of World War One, and ostensibly to honor the Muslim soldiers who had served in World War One. And that angered a lot of the country's Catholics, who saw it as sort of a perversion of laïcité, or the secularism that France was supposedly adhering to. And Sophie can talk more about this. I mean, it was quite an interesting period in France's history.
Yes, Sophie, go ahead.
Well, I think in general that this definitely the Muslim soldiers who fought in the First World War is also one of these really parts of history that seems to be forgotten by a lot of people. Not only on the within the Middle East, but also in Europe, there were many soldiers. Britain sent almost 140,000 Indian troops to the Western Front. Many of them were Muslim because a lot of them came from later Pakistan. Mm-hmm. France also deployed about 500,000 colonial subjects on European battlefields, of whom also many were Muslim. And these are things that, you know, that are important to remember. It was also the first time that there was such a big presence of Muslims on European soil in that mm-hmm. way. And they had special treatment in these regiments. And there was very specifically also propaganda during the First World War. The Germans opened a POW camp in Wunsdorf, where they built a mosque and where they tried to convince soldiers, Muslim soldiers that they captured, to join their side. So in response, you know, France also built a mosque for their soldiers. So there was kind of this propaganda battle going on. And what Germany was really trying to accomplish was trying to get Muslims in France and Britain's colonies to rise up against them, which they saw as, you know, a good tool for them to hurt these other countries. But in the end, there was no such real, that didn't really happen. Mm-hmm. But that's an important part of history that also shouldn't be forgotten. And the Mosquée de Paris was opened in 1926, really with this idea to honor these soldiers. But in effect, what ended up happening was that mostly it was targeted at elite North Africans and French tourists in a way, as it is today. You can still go there and, you know, drink a mint tea and buy a rug. It was very much. People were, you know, the North Africans who were working in Paris, they were not living in the same areas, and they were definitely not making enough money to go visit the hammam there or go to the restaurant. Right. And their factory times didn't align with the mosque. So it was clearly sort of a colonial power show.
Right. Sophie, continuing with you, then there's this other track where colonial powers are also anticipating that Islamic politics is starting to emerge. And again, I think this is important. I'd like you both to speak on this to kind of distinguish. When people hear Islamic politics today, and, you know, justifiably, frankly, from public media consumption, you think on one end of obviously what's associated with the sort of, you know, horrific terrorism of ISIS or Al-Qaeda. You might think of Iran, which there's a much more complicated history there. But these are specific tracks that involve terrorism, that involved sort of, you know, more on the right side of the political spectrum in some respects. But at this time, Islam was emerging as the same way that, you know, Indians might be re-embracing Hinduism, or people in, you know, Ceylon or Thailand were, you know, re-engineering Buddhism in certain ways and actually doing a similar project with Buddhism. And there was Western interest in Buddhism being a kind of modern rational project, and but also reinventing all native traditions in the arsenal to reverse colonialism. There's nothing specific or special about Islam in that regard. And so the Europeans are also seeing that this religion can be an ally and a tool of colonial holding, essentially, or it can be flipped back in their face. So they're trying to anticipate that as well. And then through this conversation, we'll see some parallels in policy towards Muslims today.
Well, yeah, in this period, this fear of pan-Islam, which was also a bit older, that just didn't emerge after the First World War, but had a lot to do with colonial anxiety. And you get these independent movements, for instance, in France, that are very much that link independence also to Islam. So fear about it has a lot to do with that. And there were a lot of tools of control in this sense. The French authorities kept a really close eye on all these different organizations and through different organs, like, for instance, a sort of not a trade union, but an area where they would go to get work in an office. And there would always be, you know, intelligence. People would be watching them because, yeah, Islam was almost also a tool of control in that way. And it's hard to compare, you know, I understand why, but it's still a bit difficult to compare to the situation today. Again, these colonial empires were so big and had such a big influence on politics and policy, and we don't really have that right now, or not in the same way. Mm-hmm. But
I guess there is some terrible. Yeah, there's this sort of idea of when you fear something, you can take steps to control it. And I think in a way we see that today with the kind of movement towards having something called, and I put this in kind of scare quotes, British or European Islam. As if there can be an Islam engineered in Europe that's Europe-friendly and friendly to the kind of public and society of Europe. And that involves training imams in the Netherlands and in France and sort of state-sponsored training of imams. And all of these kind of ideas are, they reflect a similar mentality, which is maybe they're governments wresting control over something that they fear or don't understand. And I think we see it today, and we also saw it in that period, though it looks very different, and maybe the entities being feared are very different.
Right. That was actually that's the parallel I was looking for, Maria, and I want you to expand on that because, you know, I think it's important to be fair and be rigorous in this conversation that there is, okay, so one of the important sort of things that you guys both note in your article is that the discourse on Islam in Europe today is, the frame is wrong because Islam is not new to Europe. And there is this very broad and deep and textured history here that involves the colonial experience, that involves migration, that involves all of these countercultural movements and anti-colonial movements and everything else. But at the same time, in Europe today, you have a challenge where all of these things are sort of happening concurrently. You have the rise of the right. You have tremendous bigotry and xenophobia and everything else that is expressed towards Muslims and people coming from the Middle East or North Africa. And then you also do have, you know, in fact, we can be quite clear, I think, you know, the distinction between an Islamic-inspired anti-colonial politics versus a, you know, why would someone be drawn to joining ISIS? That's an entirely different sort of conversation. But we can also acknowledge, I guess, to be real here, that there are legitimate security concerns and there are legitimate conversations about balancing multiculturalism and national identity and everything else. And so I guess what I'm curious about is, what do you both see, and Maria, I'll start with you, from this research and from being grounded in this history that can at least start to get us to ask the right questions and have the right sort of frame so we can start dealing with these challenges more intelligently now?
Oh, big question.
Always a big question.
So I think one thing that for me this research really illuminates is that not only is Islam not new to Europe, but the relationship between Europe and all of these different kinds of Islam and Muslims and converts is so complex. And sort of thinking about the past, we see some trends that are still helpful in explaining things today. And so one of those trends is this kind of otherizing of Islam and sort of state, the relationship between Islam and the state, which was never simple, never easy, and is really related to the colonial experience. And it's something that I think if we ignore this past, we're unable to truly understand Islam today. And if we start the narrative in the 70s or the 60s, mm-hmm. We're also neglecting a really important part of history. And I think doing that makes it seem like there's this new Islam phenomenon that is occurring in a void. And obviously, we know that's not true. It's a very long and kind of compelling history. And so I just think beginning to look at a kind of both why a broader framework for understanding the relationship between Europe and Islam and Muslims in Europe and European Muslims. And I mean, in the piece, we don't even talk about Muslims in Eastern Europe, mm-hmm. which is a totally different and really important and historic Muslim communities. But I do think that one of the problems that both of us, I'm speaking for Sophie, but have with the discourse is that it so flattens Islam and Muslim identity, and really the kind of fear of global terrorism or Al-Qaeda or ISIS really sort of drowns out other versions and expressions of Islam in society and even political Islam. And those things are very important to engage with if we really want to understand, you know, how the world works.
And I just have to interject, Sophie, I want to get your thoughts on this, but to be really, you know, fair and upfront with some of this audience, I would just underline that I think, you know, it's one thing to have what you can call, frankly, a more high-minded intellectual commitment to do what you're talking about. But I just want to also argue from the practical perspective that even mm-hmm. if you were to say that your prime concerns with these things were terrorism and were, you know, preserving social liberalism with, you know, migration from Islamic countries or whatever other concerns that you're kind of expressing and dealing with, these are the conversations and the groups and the complexity that you need to have in order to formulate the right solutions and the right responses. Just sitting back and, you know, not liking the Quran or quoting some people who have no idea what they're talking about is not going to do the very practical job. So I think it's important to underline that this isn't just, it's not just a high-minded motivation. This is the actual work of, even if your prime interest is just counterterrorism, which is a, you know, quite an important issue. But you need to engage in all of these things in a serious and rigorous way to solve for all of the concerns that you might have from, you know, from recognizing the complexity and vitality of, a you know, over a billion people on the planet, mm-hmm. to dealing with terrorism. Sophie, go ahead.
Well, I would link to that in a way that also, if you're a policymaker, historicizing and contextualizing these issues is really important, because otherwise you might not fully understand what you're actually talking about.
Right.
And you might not have the tools to then find the right measures to do something, you know, positive. And in that way, this part of Europe, because it's European history, you know, that's what's important about it as well. It's not, even when we talk about Muslim Spain, often that's talked about as in within Islamic studies, Middle Eastern history, mm-hmm. where you're thinking, well, actually, it's also European history. And this part in the interwar period, where there was so much, you know, conversation going on and a different engagement with Islam, is also part of European history. These mosques are in the center of these centers of these cities. Well, the Wormsdorf Mosque is, you know, in the middle of Berlin. It's very visual in that way as well. And if we don't forget this, and if we keep, you know, if we talk about it in this way and acknowledge this longer relationship, it does change the conversation that we have when, you know, today when people say, oh yeah, Muslims who came in the 60s and the 70s. Well, that's not the case. These other people were there before there, and they also had ideas and interaction with Europeans and maybe, you know, became European in a way.
Absolutely. The piece is When Europe Loved Islam, Sophie Spahn, Maria Hanoun, I appreciate your time. Both of you, thank you very much for joining us on the Majority Report.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, bye-bye, guys.
Bye.
All right, everybody. I look forward to your tweets and phone calls. I'm sure that they're coming. You're an Islamic apologist. It would be fun. I was thinking about that, to like pick subject areas that I know absolutely nothing about, but then just like have like a grand explanation of them, and then be able to try to like shut like I, as I say, I pretty much never look at YouTube comments, but I did when we post the clips from the Malcolm Nance interview. And Malcolm Nance is like, I think, a 2-decade-long CIA counterterrorism specialist.
I think he says 35 years in the
interview. Yeah, 35-year CIA counterterrorism specialist, who is certainly to the right of me on certain foreign policy issues, but like, you know, a not someone that my first thought would be like, oh, that guy's just like trying to like write an apology piece for Al-Qaeda. Like, what a wimp. Like a guy who spent 50 minutes on this show giving this like detailed rundown of frankly a pretty ruthless plan to eliminate ISIS. And then, because he spent time in the region and because he knows what he's talking about, he dismisses these dumb ideas about Islam that float around the internet. And then I go in the comments section, and I actually, for the first time, I start to actually admire these morons. Because it's one thing to just, I guess if I put out a video or something, you could say, like, you Muslim apologist, you know, whatever, okay, fine. That you don't know what you're talking about, but sure, I guess I'm some, you know, liberal guy or whatever. But the balls to go after a CIA counterterrorism specialist, and they're just like regressive.
I put a few extra trims on that video. The picture is him in like combat gear with a gun, and I also put in the tags like regressive left, like
total regressive left. In fact, he actually, the gun was actually a water gun. And he carried around an apology book. That was his CIA assignment. He was supposed to troop into different areas of the Middle East and do an official CIA apology.
Really?
So, yeah, that's what they do there.
That is a good
job.
The CIA
is super regressive.
I think that I like
the CIA has trigger warnings all over the place.
Apology tours.
You're just like, I thought your discourse was really problematic. And I don't think we're going to have an Al-Qaeda strategy without really checking our privilege. That's what Malcolm Nance said in the interview. Wow.
I like how you're the trigger warnings when they come up, you turn gay.
Well, I didn't want to have to spell that out, Tilly. Jesus. Trigger warning.
Look, we're all offended at triggers.
I know. Trigger warning to the trigger warning. Yeah. But I mean, that was just unbelievable. Like, again, it's one thing to say, like, you Jew apologize, but then to be like, you know, there's some other guy on YouTube who did some video about the Quran, and he would slay Malcolm Nance, 35 years CIA counterterrorism expert.
Like, motivated reasoning.
That is, I mean, wow. When they busted out with those comments in that video, I kind of like, they actually flipped from like total moron nuisances to kind of like the Doug Space almost, where I've just like, you know what? I respect the hustle. Like, if you're that committed to your dumb, then I kind of got a soft spot for you. Okay. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. That is how you can join the show. Become a member of the Majority Report today. You know that that's how this is all possible. The IMs are on. Majority Report kickback. Use Jet.com or our Amazon link. I think with Jet, is the 15% off thing still happening?
I think Sam still mentions it.
Looks like that you can still get 15% off of your first purchase with Jet, which, as you know, is a socially responsible alternative to Amazon. And apparently it's a really amazing service. Sponsor today was Harry's. Check them out. There's a link to it on the website. Subscribe to Two Dope Boys if you haven't already. It's fun promoting Two Dope Boys because we've been getting really positive feedback on it, and really, really proud of how that's turning out. We will see you all on the flip side. And to the public, Sam is back tomorrow with a debate with Jimmy Dore. Peace.